Good morning, everyone, and welcome, or good afternoon, rather. Sorry, it's not a good start. It is Monday after all. Welcome back to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, as always, Nicholas Larimer, and today we are very well represented in the Western Cape. We have, of course, Mr. Sholin Boysen. Sholin, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Nick, and yourself?
I'm doing very well. And our other compatriot from the Cape, Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Nick. And so you are too.
Indeed, I am. Excellent. The freezing cold front has passed us by for now, but I'm sure it will return. But in the meantime, I'm just enjoying that crystal clear sort of blue winter sky.
Excellent.
Anyway, let's get started with our first story. And this is a report that came from IOL, but it's about Etegwini or Durban specifically, but it kind of is a story that plays out in every single municipality in the country. So Mayor Nkolisi Kaunda recently detailed the impact of cable theft, saying we've lost over 800 million rand as a result of power and cable theft, and that's not factoring in the impact of the outages. That's just the impact of replacing cables and repairing infrastructure. Goes on to say, a spokesperson said these costs exclude consequential losses due to production losses and inconvenience to customers. 800 million is inclusive of cable and infrastructure theft for the city's electricity unit. Stolen cables are sold for scrap while the city must spend more to replace it. The city loses millions of rands every year from cable theft. We urge all citizens to demonstrate civic pride and a sense of co-ownership of resources and assets by reporting any information they have on these incidents in their community. Acts of vandalism and theft are taking place in our communities there, and they cannot be addressed by the municipality and police alone. A DA councillor, Mzombo Bili, said, in the Otongati area, theft is truly concerning. The cable gets stolen, they get replaced, they're stolen again. The issue needs to be addressed at law enforcement agencies as the culprits are known to the community. We are faced with the problem of electricity theft and cable theft, and there seems to be no plan to address the matter. So obviously a lot of the concern here is particularly that the city administration seems to be putting the blame at least a little bit on the community, saying that people are not ratting out the cable thieves. But this is not a problem isolated to Durban. Joburg suffers from it to an enormous degree. And Michael, you said you did a little bit of research on this in preparation for the show, and you said that you found some truly spectacular things about Cape Town and its problems with cable theft. Do you want to give us your thoughts on this issue and what you found out?
Indeed. I mean, when you first mentioned the story, the first thing that I remembered was covering a presentation years ago, and I couldn't quite remember when it was, by this wonderful organization in Cape Town, City of Cape Town unit called the Anti-Ferrous Metal Theft Squad, which is delightfully called the Copperheads, and they're actually very effective. But the particular thing that I was that I remembered when I was just trying to find the detail of, I eventually did track it down. It related to a presentation by the then chairperson of the city of the Copperheads, a chap called Peter van Dalen. And I unfortunately not entirely sure whether he's still there or whether this is still his role. But this dated back to August 2008, so an awful long time ago, 14 years ago. It was a very serious issue then, and the headline of this particular piece was how copper theft is ruining the economy and what's being done about it. But the fact that I wanted to highlight that leapt out at me at the time was this absolutely wonderful thing, where van Dalen noted that Cape Town exported 77 million rands worth of copper last year, and we don't have a single copper mine. And of course, what this underscores is that the whole scrap metal issue is underpinned by a very, very vibrant and substantial commercial market. Buyers and sellers and thieves, of course, all kind of working together. And there's an awful lot of clearly aiding and abetting by people who would no doubt be horrified to be compared to common criminals. And the fact is, a story just last month in News 24 the current mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis, talking about, and again, this telling word in the headline, cable theft is crippling the city's infrastructure. And it's, you know, it's a story that talks about 2 million rand a week it costs the city to just to fix streetlights, and that's only one element of the copper theft that's going on. And you know, there are lots of other detail. The copperheads are still at it. This is now 14 years later. Hill Lewis says this month the city's metal theft unit made 56 arrests for cable theft. So clearly, you know, it's a very vibrant part of the cowboy economy in South Africa. And this is pardon me, this telling detail that Jordan Hill mentions that the price of copper is at a 20-year high at the moment. So that kind of explains in broader terms why this is such a problem. It's just very lucrative. And it's a major, major law and order issue or policing issue and a big, big headache for cities. The fact of it.
For sure. I mean, one of the big problems in SA is that, you know, all of our municipalities – from the well-run to the not well-run, have to spend an enormous amount of money replacing stuff that gets damaged or stolen. And this really limits the effectiveness of municipal budgets and how well they can be spent. But the sense I kind of get from this issue is it's kind of like a symptom of a lot of South Africa's bigger underlying issues. So, you know, people steal copper because they're poor and they need some kind of economic opportunity. They steal copper because they can, because the police are not effective. The gangs don't get shut down because they're, the police are often bribed or somehow maybe sometimes complicit in the selling, which means they don't target the right dealers. What do you think we can do about this issue to solve it? I mean, it doesn't seem like anything will be a quick fix.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think anything will be a quick fix. And I'm sure that if we can get this right in one part of the country, I hope that others would also be able to eventually, you know, like replicate the solution to the implementation of things in that region. I think specifically in an area like Ithekwini, you know, there is a rather volatile political situation, which makes these criminal entities and these criminal, you know, rather bandits take advantage of situations like this, especially when those in power or those in the municipality, those running municipalities are rather distracted. Like, I know that in Ithekwini, we have a situation where, you know, there's a lot of coalition arrangements that people are focused on holding on to power, especially the governing party in this area, like the ANC. And in some cases, you know, in classic ANC style, you might just get assassinated by one of your past team members. So you really have a lot of worry, things to worry.
Tends to distract one from the issues of governance when you're fearing assassination.
Exactly. And this really causes you to neglect what your basic role is in the situation, which is actually to serve the people and to provide basic services like electricity and things like these, and, you know, and getting the basics right so that people can actually be employed or for businesses to actually function properly, where something like this is actually for people partaking criminal activities, this is supposed to be a last resort. It's not even actually supposed to be something people think about, because the jobs are plentiful and there's a lot of places to work at, you know, and services are actually provided for you properly. And unfortunately, this is not the case in most of our municipalities in this country. And it is rather the wild beast. I'm like, this is like, it's rather bizarre to think that the amount that this accumulates is 800 million rand. And just to think that that doesn't even include the, you know, the cost of doing business, of people, people's electricity supply being disrupted. Those things are not even included in this 800 million. So for all we know, this could balloon to up to a billion rand in this municipality. And that is costing a lot, especially for it to be in one of South Africa's, you know, major cities in Durban. So yeah, that is rather concerning.
So the one of the things, so it might be worth mentioning as well, that cable theft can often be pretty dangerous. Some of these guys, they don't really know entirely what they're doing, and they fry themselves every now and again, which is quite gruesome to behold.
Mm. Mm.
So you'd think that if people had other opportunities, a lot of them wouldn't go with this. But one of the points that's made by the Itagüini city officials here is they kind of put quite a lot of emphasis on, they say, well, the community is not doing its part and policing itself properly. And I think obviously some of that is just kind of blame shifting. But I think there is probably something to be said that we do have this problem in South Africa, Michael, of people not really feeling like they have ownership of the stuff around them. That's why we, you know, we've seen people burn down schools before, burning local clinics, that kind of thing. What do you make of that angle of this?
I think that's quite an interesting thing. There's a kind of association, perhaps, that a lot of the stuff is government. And to the extent that the government has demonstrably failed to deliver all the good things which people had quite rationally anticipated would be coming their way, at least in the decade or decade and a half after 1994, perhaps appreciating that it takes time to get things done. The fact that it has been so, the delivery has been so disappointing in so many ways, perhaps reinforces that idea that, you know, why the hell should we care? This doesn't belong to us. It belongs to them. You know, it's not our problem. Just an interesting detail in the story about Jordan Hill Lewis that you reminded me of was he's saying that that there's been a 97% reduction in train usage in Cape Town. Now, this is a massive commuter a service in the city, or used to be, very, very effective. You can move thousands of people quite rapidly in the peak hours without, you know, congestion. It can run like clockwork, and you're moving, you know, as many people as were involved in the Normandy landings. You do that in the morning and do that in the evening, and if the trains are working properly, it's a seamless operation. But there's been a 97% reduction. And Jordan Hillu says that the loss of copper, the cable theft, is a very, very significant element of that failure. So, that, I mean, that brings home to you that, you know, it does actually affect people. You know, an awful lot of people have a direct interest in seeing this being tackled and being fixed. And yet, you know, it's perhaps not entirely implausible that there's kind of rational perverse sort of rationality at work here, that people are not really caring that much, because the perception is that this belongs to an uncaring government.
I think that's definitely correct. All right, so we're going to move on now, but I just do want to remind everyone, if you do like this show, please subscribe to us on the podcast apps, please leave us good reviews, and please like the video, subscribe to our YouTube channel, that kind of thing. We really do appreciate it. It helps us. It feeds the almighty algorithm, which determines the fate of of all of us in media these days, so we really appreciate it if you did that. So our next story is, shall we say, a contentious issue, and this is regarding the Zimbabwe exemption permits, the ZEPs. So these are basically, as far as I understand them, an exemption given to a lot of Zimbabwean citizens that allows them to live and work in South Africa much more easily than people from other countries in particular. And they're relatively easy to get, even for quite unskilled people. You can get them at the border. And they have been very important for 178,000 Zimbabweans who are in the country legally under the ZEP, which allows them to find work here. But perhaps seeing the writing on the wall electorally, the government has increasingly become concerned that it looks like it's too friendly to foreign immigrants. And so the Minister of Home Affairs has decided that he is going to cancel, or at least not renew, these Zimbabwe exemption permits at the end of December. This has seen him take the Helen Suzman Foundation has taken the minister to court, saying that while he does have the power to do this, they do not believe that the decision was made in the correct way. The Helen Suslin Foundation says, we do not contend that the minister is obliged to extend exemptions in perpetuity, nor do we argue that permit holders may never such have their permit withdrawn. This case concerns the manner in which the minister reached his decision. It should have been taken following a fair process for good reason and with a meaningful opportunity for permit holders to regularize their status. A decision of this consequence acting more than 178,000 people required proper information on who would be affected, including children, and a careful assessment of the current conditions in Zimbabwe. The Helen Suslin Foundation went on to say that ZEP holders will lose their jobs, businesses, and homes. They will lose access to banking services. Their children could be denied access to schooling, medical care, and social services, and they'll be forced to return to Zimbabwe. They will be put in a desperate choice to remain in South Africa as undocumented migrants with all the vulnerability that attaches to such status, or return to a Zimbabwe that for all intents and purposes is unchanged from the country they fled. There are thousands of children who have been born in South Africa to ZEP holders during this time who have never even visited their parents' country of origin. So quite a lot of issues here. One is, of course, that a lot of these people are going to go from being legal to illegal. I guess this is part of the problem here, is that the ZEP was always a sort of temporary special status. But Sholin, what are your thoughts on this? I think, you know, there's a case to be made that, a lot of immigrants from other African countries, not always the greatest thing, especially if they're unskilled. But at the same time, I feel like South Africa does have a special obligation to Zimbabwe, considering how complicit we have been in the empire. What do you make of this, Sholin? Looks like we may have lost Sholin there. So, Michael, same question to you.
Sorry, if you could just repeat it. There we are.
Sholin, are you with us? I think he's still gone. So, Michael, what do you make of the Zimbabwean exemption permit issue? Do you think that government should extend it or not?
No, yes. I mean, I think it's crazy. It's kind of punitive action that completely misreads the situation, or some of the points that you raised, the fact that we do have a responsibility to a country that whose decline we have contributed very considerably, and that really, you know, the whole immigration situation, I think, calls for a much more mature and creative way of thinking. They're going after 178,000 people and potentially causing all kinds of mayhem. And yet the problem is so much bigger than that. And that what, you know, what South Africa really is challenged to do is to rethink its entire approach, I think, to immigration, given that it is now, you know, a de facto issue in our society. We've got millions of people here. It's great tension. These both elements have got to be thought through and dealt with. And I sort of, you know, I keep thinking back to the thing that I was looking for. It distracted me briefly. There was the tail end of a report which we commissioned in, I think, 2016, so a good few years ago. Which was sponsored actually by a remark that Lindiwe Zulu made at the time, saying essentially that, you know, South Africans perhaps have something to learn from foreigners who come here and who set up shops and who sort of have get up and go and vim, and they, you know, get on their feet and start earning a living and so on. And so this report was actually looking at, you know, why is this? How is it that refugees in the society where there's such high unemployment, not great economic growth and so on, how is it that this body of people who come here from outside South Africa's borders, who are strangers in a sense to our economy and our way of life and one thing or another, manage to succeed? And he examines all the different facets of this, things that we are quite familiar with. But it does, he concludes with these lines, you know, this is now years ago and the challenge remains. He says their success, the success of immigrants, is testimony to a rare triumph of the human spirit and the endurance of allegedly outmoded values like hard work and perseverance. As Lindiwe Zulu intuited, they have something important to tell us. It's not too late to listen. And, you know, this remains the challenge. It's shocking that it does, but this is now where we are you know, umpteen years later. And one wonders whether, you know, is there perhaps room for some kind of incentive scheme to get foreigners to become more involved with locals and to gain some kind of advantage in that way, to become taxpayers, but to get rebates if they are employing South Africans or working with South Africans. I don't know. I don't really know what the answer is, but very clearly, I think stories like this underscore the fact that so much of our policy actually creates more problems rather than providing any solutions.
I think one of the other things that recommends Zimbabweans as opposed to, say, Mozambicans or, I don't know, people from the Congo is that often, although Zimbabwe's education system has declined somewhat, it still has produced a lot of very well-educated people who are able, I think, to contribute to our economy a lot more than, say, people from Mozambique who don't necessarily speak any of our languages, because, you know, not that many South Africans speak Tsonga, and, you know, their second language might then be Portuguese, and that's much more difficult for them to integrate. Whereas Zimbabweans, at least people from Matabeleland, northern Ndebele is very similar to the Nguni languages like Xhosa, Zulu, so it's much easier for them to integrate here. And of course, a lot of them speak really good English and have good educations. Sholin, what do you make of all this? How do you feel about the issue of immigration into this country, specifically from Zimbabwe, but also more generally?
Yeah. No, for sure, Nick. You know, I have very favorable views of things like border security and, you know, enforcing those legal procedures that need to take place, because, I mean, we are a country that, you know, and we are, I mean, we are guys who believe in the rule of law, at its foundation. And so, yeah, but I think in this case, especially with the ANC government and our Home Affairs Minister, I do think that for a long time they have recently especially been trying to scapegoat refugees and, you know, trying to build up that populist rhetoric because they see that it's in the social media and, you know, people are starting to have unfavorable views of refugees and so forth. But it is also very dangerous because it can easily lead to xenophobic acts, and something that is very common in South Africa. We have seen, you know, terrible situations where xenophobic attacks have turned violent and deadly in many cases. So it is a rather dangerous direction for us to be going in. And I also found it very interesting that the minister, you know, he backed up his decision making based on social media support. Instead of, you know, making a decision based on reliable research and assessment. And if he wants any research to be done, I'm sure he can contact the IRR. We will be able to definitely help him with his decision making, for sure. And as Michael said earlier, I think we should definitely not forget that the reasons why many Zimbabweans run away from the political turmoil in the country is because for the ANC for the longest time, you know what, when Mugabe was at his prime as a dictator, the ANC just decided to sit back and watch all this devastation occur in the country, not realizing the impact it will have not only on Zimbabwe, but on the Southern African region completely, because they really decided to ignore the fact that, you know, turmoil and instability in one country in our region might eventually spill over to multiple countries. And eventually we're starting to see things in Mozambique where, you know, there's the terrorist situation over in Mozambique, and that can so easily, so quickly spill over into South Africa and into countries like Botswana or Namibia, other neighboring countries in our region. So, yeah, the ANC government, I should say, definitely let the ball slip on that one.
No, I think that's a really good point to remember, is how, at least in the SADC region, most of the countries are extremely tightly linked together, particularly since, and then Zimbabwe especially, ever since its economy fell over. In a lot of ways, it's become sort of unofficially integrated with South Africa, not because the governments wanted it to, but just because basically that was how the people there survived. So whatever happens to them kind of always affects us, and vice versa. South Africa heads for difficult times, and Zimbabwe is going to get even worse. Any final thoughts on this, Michael, before we move on?
I'm just noticing it. Whiskey Jack's comment that, you know, research is difficult and therefore hard to get a handle on the scale of the problem and so on. And I think that certainly is valid. One does have to take care, and it is an issue. People do feel it. I just think that we need to be speaking a very different kind of language about people who are living in our midst, who are contributing to the economy, from whom there's perhaps a lot to be learned on the one hand. And another comment, I saw somebody was saying how Somalis employed South Africans. So they're part of our society, they're part of our economy. And to turn them into, the subjects of administrative punitive action and so on is just really going in the wrong direction.
Right. A lot more good could probably be done rather than cancelling the ZEP, just securing the border properly. That would probably be a better first step. Okay, so let's move on to our last story for today. And this is about two cops in Joburg. A whole bunch of top cops in Joburg who have been arrested in connection with a kidnapping ring. So recently, a businessman was kidnapped in Bryanston and held for ransom. The person, I think, got out of it without anything too bad happening. But relating to that case, two officers from the Johannesburg Crime Intelligence Bureau, three Gauteng traffic officials, and a Joburg Metro cop have all been arrested, as well as two other civilians in connection with this. And this is exactly the kind of thing which I think really shakes people's confidence in the police. You just can't have a world where the police are involved in kidnapping people. Michael, your thoughts?
Yeah, it is extraordinary. And as we were chatting a bit earlier about this particular story and how symptomatic it is of several stories that we read perhaps on a daily basis every day, that brings them something about our future, which I think is important to mention. And that is that these stories highlight things that we will need as a society to fix or to confront and work out how to fix, probably only once the ANC is out of the way, because it's become clearer by the day that the ANC, as it's presently constituted, is not going to be able to really tackle these things. And these are really key areas of South African life. And just a few that come to mind: law and order, policing, as in this case, healthcare, schooling, the economy, empowerment. You know, to think that after 28 years, we still use this word so often, empowerment, is just absolutely crazy. And it's purely because we just have not done nearly enough about it in over 28 years, which is a shocker. So the key thing really for me, you know, it's almost amusing, the story. It's horrifying. All the emotions that so many South African stories bring to mind. But, to think about it coldly, one's really thinking about, you know, what do we do about this to fix it in the future. There's no reason why South Africa should be subjected to this kind of thing. We need to have a plan to fix it. And what that really requires of us, I think citizens, but certainly organizations, institutes, think tanks, academics, is to devote increasingly rational attention to alternatives, to ways of fixing this, getting it done, that have to be practical. We have to accept that, you know, we're not going to be able to gain great changes in 6 months or even a year, but we need to methodically take steps to actually achieve improvements. So that's really what the story means to me, I think, is a larger picture.
Sherlock, any thoughts to close out the episode?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do find this very problematic, you know, when the very people who are entrusted with sustaining our safety and security in this country are basically the very ones who are violating the laws that they were mandated to enforce. I do think that it makes it even worse that this is taking place in an economic hub of South Africa, in Joburg, because why would foreign or domestic investors want to, you know, invest their resources, their money, their time into the country when that is at risk of being, stolen, or they themselves are at risk of being kidnapped by the law enforcement agencies in this country. And Nick, I can definitely guarantee you that there are people, foreign or domestic investors, who are looking and seeing these stories and immediately think that there is no way I can run a business in a country or a city where my goods and services are not safe. So yeah, that is rather unfortunate, and I hope that it is rectified. And I think that accountability should start at the top, because in cases like these are officials who obviously see that accountability is not something our police services are fond of, so they think that they will definitely get away with it.
No, I think that's definitely the case. Anyway, we are out of time for today, so thank you very much for listening. We hope that you found the show interesting and enjoyable, or that you got some goodness out of it. And we will be back tomorrow, of course, with the Daily Friend Show. Hope you all have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.